Hello everybody, welcome back to Sunday morning, and we're going to do this class on the six perfections today, and we're starting on a new topic called the perfection of patience, so that should be quite interesting. Okay, let's begin as we normally do, by doing a short meditation. Looks like Yvette has difficulties.
Yvette, can you hear? Not so good. You are quite quiet, Eddie, so I don't know. Are you sitting as close as you can to the microphone?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you hear me okay? Folks out there, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, Bruce can.
Yeah. Can
yep, okay.
Yeah, I can.
Okay, Meta's there. Okay, so first of all, let's make yourself comfortable in your chair so that your back is straight. Your chin is tucked in ever so slightly, and that you place your hands wherever you like. And when you are comfortable in your chair with your back straight, breathe normally and naturally. So letting the body breathe itself. And as the body breathes itself, become aware of the movements and feelings that take place around the abdomen and the upper chest. And as the body continues to breathe itself, and you are aware of the movements of the abdomen and upper chest, allow yourself to be present and relaxed. And you breathe normally and naturally. And while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas arrive from the 10 directions of space and appear above your head. And all the sentient beings of the six realms appear sitting at your feet. And you acknowledge the suffering of all sentient beings. And you know of the compassion and wisdom and skill of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And thinking that you're going to rely upon the compassion, wisdom, and skill of all these victorious beings. Decide to put an end to your own suffering. Decide to put an end to the causes of that suffering. And decide to help others do the same. I think this is the purpose of this life and every other life we will have until we are finally fully awakened. They think, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In strengthening our aspiration and setting it as a very good foundation where you can recite the four immeasurable thoughts together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, to accomplish enlightenment, we need to abandon certain thoughts and behaviors and adopt others. We need to purify the mind and accumulate all the causes for enlightenment. These are, in summary, within the seven-limb prayer. So we could recite that together. Reverently, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Then we make an offering of a mandala to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas above us, thinking that through doing so we are letting go of the clinging that we have to our own body, to the world in general, and to the merits we've accumulated over time. And think that in the absence of the clinging, wonderful pure land appears whereby we can give teachings to others. So this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, the four continents, the sun and the moon. Having that carefully in front of you, imagine this to be the Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Bhururatna Mandalakam Naryatayahami. So the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas accept the offering and they smile at us with delight. This vast merit field above us begins to dissolve into light and melt into the central figure, Shakyamuni Buddha. An emanation leaves his heart, moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing the same direction as you are. The emanation descends through space, entering the crown of your head, coming down to rest at your heart. And as radiance starts to expand, filling your body and mind, rays of light go out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space. Within space, all living beings are purified and fully awakened. From the heart of each of these awakened beings, light rays go out, making offerings to all the Buddhas and purifying others. And we just allow the body to breathe normally and naturally amidst the radiance. And we acknowledge there's no difference between ourselves and others. There's no self or other, or inner or outer. And the rays of light begin to withdraw from the 10 directions of space, and they re-enter your body at the level of the heart. And become aware of your breathing. That you are embodied. And acknowledge you have this potential to fully awaken, and you're determined to do so. And as a condition for awakening, think that you're engaged in the study of the perfections, and in particular the perfection of patience. Now, breathing in deeply through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and allow yourself to be aware of your chair and your body, and that you're in front of the screen. Allow your eyes to open, your limbs to move about, just make yourself feel quite comfortable. And I'll open up the share screen and begin the class. So this is basically the 13th class in the perfections, but this is the first one on the perfection of patience. So during the week, we sent out a number of documents, some of the teachings and the questions. And these questions, one of the questions asked, like, where are we actually in the text? And they asked for a sort of an outline. So in the first few pages of commentary were about this outline. And here it is in a very sort of brief way. So we've gone through the trainings of the small scope, then the medium scope. So these are trainings shared with persons of small capacity, trainings shared with beings of medium capacity. And then we've entered the trainings for the person of great capacity. And a person becomes a person of great capacity by entering into the Mahayana, developing the mind of enlightenment, and then over time learning the bodhisattva deeds. And we've gone through the practice of generosity, ethical discipline, and today we begin the practice of patience. So there were some questions asked here. And Geshe talked about what we're training to do is to try and develop experiences of the path. And the question was, in what section do we find how to develop the mind of enlightenment? How do we bring about the experiences of the development of the mind of enlightenment? Can anybody remember what that might be? Any answers yet, Biffy?
Eddie, if you stop the screen share, you might be able to see people waving at you, or
that's right. It's probably a good one to do with this one here, because there's quite a few questions and answers. So, in essence, it's in the second section, you know, how to develop the mind of enlightenment. They asked us then, and what were the methods that we used to develop the mind of enlightenment? So there were two methods. Can anybody remember what they were? The first method was the sevenfold cause and effect method. What would be the second? Anyone?
Taking, giving.
Yeah, but sorry, equalizing, exchanging.
Exchanging self for others, yes.
Yeah. And the essence of that is, as you said, Bruce, the giving and taking practice.
Eddie, just before you go on, if you change the view to gallery view, you'll be able to see everybody.
Okie dokie, thank you.
Yep, you can just leave it on that. Yeah.
So the third question was this question, so how do we meditate on the topics of the stages of the path? So Geshe gave us some advice there. Does anybody recollect what the advice was? Linda, any idea? Your thing's off, yeah.
You have to do an analytical meditation, I guess, on the sevenfold cause and effect, or the equalizing, exchanging self with others.
Yeah, so to use analytical meditations without changing the order of the topics and without adding or omitting material. Then there are some obstacles that we might meet and that we would need to overcome as we engage in the practices. Can anybody recollect what those were?
You did talk about distraction from the topic when meditating, laxity and excitement.
That's right. So laxity and excitement were the main obstacles to overcome as we analyze the topics. Other obstacles we might meet was if we ourselves added unnecessary material to the meditations or omitted relevant material. So these could be obstacles as we try to generate experiences of these two topics, equalizing, exchanging self for others, and the seven-point cause and effect method. Then he asked them, can we attain enlightenment through the attainment of the mind of enlightenment alone? This is a nice simple question, isn't it? It's either a yes or no. What do you reckon, meta? It's a no. That's right. We can't do it. Okay. Why not? Why can't we do it? Why can't we do it just on just having the mind of enlightenment alone?
The mind of enlightenment is kind of like a decision that you want to do something. So you want to, you know, become enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings, but you actually have to go and do something. You can't just have that thought of, that'd be nice, I'll just take care of everybody, but you have to actually do something about exactly. That's it. That's where the bodhisattva deeds are.
Yeah, that's right. We need to do something, and the something is to engage in the bodhisattva deeds. That's right. So the next question is, you know, like, why is it necessary to engage in the bodhisattva deeds? And the answer is, just as Linda pointed out, if we just have the wish, we won't become enlightened. We actually have to do more than just wish for it. Then there's another question. Why can we not become a Buddha through the practice of method and wisdom separately? Rosemary?
Because a bird has two wings.
Okay, and that means?
So wisdom, you can't, if you have wisdom without compassion, it's a very cold and clinical, and it doesn't necessarily, you're not necessarily doing it for 100% the right basis. If you have compassion without wisdom, then you might be directing your compassion in the wrong direction. Now, I know this is probably a lower scope response, but it's the one I'm most familiar with.
Okay. Anybody else add anything to that, to what Rosemary said? Bruce?
He did talk about achieving the two bodies.
That's right. So, right. We need the wisdom and compassion to be unified to achieve the two bodies of a Buddha. If they're practiced separately, then we won't achieve these two bodies. Now, a lot of the discussion in this section is focused on Lama Tsongkhapa preventing us having a wrong idea. What's the wrong idea? Anyone? Mr. Chris, what's the wrong idea that Lama Tsongkhapa is arguing, is trying to stop us have? Or Caroline? What do you think? Anyone else? The wrong idea is that we can achieve enlightenment with wisdom alone. So wisdom alone will not help us achieve the two bodies of a Buddha. We need to actually integrate it with the method side. And this is what these, you know, deeds are, aren't they? To get these bodhisattva deeds and the perfection of them. Okay, so I'm going back to the screen again now. Oh, sorry. Share screen. Yep. So here we were. This is, so there's quite a few, four or five questions or so asked on this section here. Just as you know, this is what Geshe normally does. When we begin a new section, he'll go back and try and get us to review what we've done, so we actually know what we've done and what we're about to do next. Now, for the answers, of course, I relied upon the text that I sent out to you all, and also these two books in particular, the Great Treatise, Lama Tsongkhapa's Labrum Chenmo, and in the book above it, Steps on the Path to Enlightenment. So where are we now? We're just beginning this patience section, and the questions that we'll be doing today are really focused around what patience is and how to begin the cultivation of patience. And this section has got like five parts. First is what patience is, and the second is how to begin the cultivation of patience. Then the next three are the divisions of patience, how to practice, and a summary. And no doubt we'll go through that in the next few weeks. But today we're really on this area here. And we're looking at this training in the perfection of patience. And in particular, 16 questions and, of course, their answers. So let's have a look at the first question. So this question is about the different types of patients there are. So I'm sure you'll all know how many there are. There are three. And these are disregarding the harm done to you. It's the first one, right? So the first type is the usual way we think about patience. And being able to bear any kind of harm or pain or misery just caused by others. Now, the ability not to be bothered by difficulties comes through understanding. So it's not just the gritting your teeth and putting up with it. Patience is accepting whatever happens, because we understand the nature of the situation and what has caused it. And knowing that, then we disregard the harms and hurts of others. Second is to accept suffering which arises in your mind stream. So when we experience suffering, it's quite possible to become discouraged and lose our courage. So this second type of patience is being able to voluntarily accept hardships, such as physical pain or emotional misery, as we work towards our goal. So our objective for us is enlightenment for the benefit of others. The objective has to be positive, religious or helpful. If the ability to accept whatever difficulties occur while pursuing it is to be called patience. And the third type of patience is having certainty in the teachings. So this really is talking about thinking about the nature of reality, causality and emptiness. So sometimes when people are unfamiliar with concepts such as karma or shunyata or emptiness, then they become a little bit impatient or uneasy about it. And they become impatient as it's explained. So this type of patience, this third type of patience, is having the ability to learn, to analyze, to understand subjects, all from the perspective of ultimate truth. So three types of patience.
Eddie, can you just expand on that a little bit about what do you mean by all from the perspective of ultimate truth? Like, what does that mean in practice?
Well, in practice, you need to recollect that you as the person who is doing the practice, whatever you're doing, you're empty of inherent nature. You don't have any intrinsic nature. But you exist in mere name. The activity that you're doing has no intrinsic nature. It also exists in mere name. And the goal that you're set out to achieve, enlightenment itself, has no intrinsic nature and exists in mere name. So they call it the three circles, the three cycles. Sometimes you can even call it the doors of emptiness, signlessness and wishlessness. So we enter the door of the perfections, knowing that we are empty, the activities we engage in are empty and lack intrinsic nature, and the goal has no intrinsic nature. But we ourselves as persons and the activities and the goal exist in mere name or as dependent arisings.
That's great, because I always wondered what those three were in Guru Puja, signlessness, wishlessness, and what was it, the three?
Wishlessness or aspirationlessness.
Yeah, great.
Okay. So let's go on to this next one, because we know the next slide, isn't it? It talks about the three hindrances or the three incompatible factors. So these, of course, are the first one is hostility. So this is actually the opposite of patience. And hostility here can mean either a hatred or ill will. Now, sometimes, oftentimes in the text you'll see it is anger, but actually it's anger is slightly lesser than this ill will and the hatred. The second is hostility and then a lack of courage. So this is sort of referring to our, we don't accept the hardship in pursuing our goal. So we get angry, we have hatred, and there we don't want to go any further in terms of achieving enlightenment. Because of the difficulties. So you remember that story with Shariputra to illustrate this? So Shariputra one day was approached by a sort of a demonic being and asked for his right hand. So Shariputra, as he was on the path of preparation, first stage of path of preparation. So he'd actually entered the Bodhisattva vehicle, and he was on the very first level, what they call the level of the earth. And so he wanted to help this demon, so he got his left hand and got a knife and cut off his right hand, picked up his right hand and then gave it to the demon. And the demon wouldn't accept it, said, how could you be so disrespectful to me and give me a gift with the hand that you wipe your bottom with, the left hand? And then Shariputta thought, there's just no way. these buggers, there's no way of helping them to become enlightened. And so he lost the wish. So this lack, this sense of lack of courage. Right? And then there's the last, is what they call disbelief and dislike. So when you, this is a terrible thing. You know? So you said just before about the, how everything lacks intrinsic nature and exists in mere name. So when you forget that, then these sort of things can come up. Everything becomes too heavy. Everything becomes too hard. So the opposite of the third type of patience is a dislike or a lack of desire to do the things necessary to become enlightened. When we lack the wisdom that realizes the true nature of reality, we don't want to engage in difficult activities. So in this context, anger, discouragement, and dislike are all referred to as sort of impatience. So this last one too, disbelief and dislike. Remember here, when we talk about emptiness and things existing in mere name, we're saying that things exist dependently. Of course, one of the dependencies is name. But we often forget that, and things don't appear to exist dependently. They appear to exist intrinsically. And so, of course, if we grasp to those appearances, then things, then our sense of dislike arises, our sense of anger, dislike arises, discouragement arises. Everything becomes too solid. So the next question had to do with this thing called pseudo-reasoning. There's another type of reasoning we can use that's called contradictory reasoning, a reason of contradiction. And the example given was, I don't want to study because I don't understand. So the Gesta said to us, if you don't understand, you must study. So I've given this picture, he says, because you've actually turned reasoning on its head. So I remember hearing this, actually I was there when he gave this teaching, and it was like, I never forget it, it really shocked me, you know. I thought, wow, I'm the same as, I don't want to do this because I don't understand.
And Eddie, I remember at Chenrezi Institute when I borrowed Venerable Pema's desk to sit at during the BSP, and inside the desk was this big sticker that she'd written saying, it's difficult now because you didn't study well in the past, you didn't study well before,
yeah.
as a way just like this of encouragement.
Yeah, so I think, this, like I said, it was very shocking to me to hear this because I knew this is how I thought. So if we find ourselves going along similar lines of reasoning, just remind yourself, my God, this is not reasonable. This is pseudo-reasoning. Or
we do this all the time in our culture, Eddie. It's like, I'm no good at maths, I just leave that alone. Or
yeah, you go like, why not? Well, how come you're no good, or why don't you want to do it? So I don't understand it. So he's sort of saying this, if you don't understand something, then you really must study more. You must, if you wish to understand it, of course, that is. But for most of us, if we don't understand, then we don't have any wish to understand. So then we say, I don't want to study. Yeah.
So is part of that that we turn it on its head, because if we do start investigating something that completely confuses us or we don't understand, we take it personally as, that cognitive fusion of, therefore I am an idiot. or you know, I'm no good. Because we can't understand something, then we think we're not worth anything or we're no good.
Yeah, that's part of it. Some of it, and here it's like we've lost one of the sense of patience we should have. Yeah, you know, that last one was it? Patience to understand Dharma.
Yep.
But behind that is just what you're suggesting with it. This cognitive fusion, the sort of ignorance. We misunderstand who we are and how things exist, and we fuse what we don't understand to be with our lack of understanding to be stupid. So we've got the grasping happening, and now the grasping coming with a sense of anger and the impatience that comes with it. So our next question is, what's the measure of having perfected patience? So what is the measure of having perfected patience? Anyone?
Is it stopping being angry?
Gee, that's pretty close to it. One of the answers I give, Gesi Sopa says, the measure of it, the mental strength not to embrace anger and hatred is the perfection of patience. So that's it in a sort of a nutshell, very, very brief. Anyone else? There's a bit more fuller answer, isn't there, in the Lam Rim Chenmo?
It said, yeah, when you completed the conditioning of your mind to the point where you have stopped anger.
That's right. This is, you simply complete your conditioning to a state of mind where you've stopped your anger and the like. So, and the like would be like resentment, impatience, anger, all those sort of things. Yeah, that sense of that we just saw before, yeah, I can't do it. So it's not contingent upon all living beings becoming free from an undisciplined conduct. It's just this idea of, as we said, conditioning to a state of mind, conditioning the mind to a state of mind whereby you've stopped your anger and the like. So last week, I think we had a question that sort of went, when does this actually happen? And so last week we talked, and that was in relationship to the practice of ethics, wasn't it? So when it actually takes, when it's actually happened, in the Middle Way Consequence School, it takes place on the third ground for patience. On the second ground was for ethical conduct. So thereby we've completely conditioned to the mind where that's where the anger sort of stops. The question here that said, with what kind of thoughts are we able to accept the suffering in our mind? So this is the second type of patience, isn't it? Okay, any ideas, people? What kind of thoughts can we generate to accept suffering that takes place within ourselves? Linda?
Oh, hang on. That's it. So thinking that the cause of my suffering is in fact the actions that I put in place previously, and these are the ripening seeds on my own mind stream that I've placed there.
Yep.
So stop getting angry at anybody else, because it's your problem. You put it there.
You created it. That's right. Now we're experiencing it.
Yep.
Isn't that? Yep.
Hang on, you can unmute, Yvette. Let's just see, ask to unmute. Yep,
to recognise our emptiness. what part is exactly suffering? Is it
we can bring emptiness into the picture for sure. Yeah. Anyone else?
Eddie, it could be that you just say to yourself, they know not what they do. You know, people that are, you know, triggering our anger, I suppose is the way to say it. They're not in control. They can't control their own disturbing emotions. They're just berserk.
And then we could, saying that, then we could put it back on ourselves and say, neither can I, because I'm suffering. Okay. So I could say this is the fruit of suffering, just as Linda pointed out, and now this fruit is being exhausted. And I accept this as the taking of suffering in the Tonglen practice. And as Yvette pointed out, we could also recollect emptiness. So that the suffering that we're experiencing is a dependent arising, and then we could go, so it's the fruit of suffering. I'm actually experiencing the effect. Effects have causes, and while experiencing the effect, it's coming to an end, just through impermanence. So there are many different things we can use whereby we can accept suffering. So if we accept suffering, then we can do something with it. If we don't accept it, then it'll just keep coming back and harming us. In fact, I guess I said at one stage, so remember this is the second type of patience talking about, accepting the suffering arising in your mind stream. You see, sometimes when you suffer, you can become angry. You might even become discouraged because your mind becomes deflated and you lose courage. But remember, from time to time, you did meditate on giving and taking. When suffering occurs, you can think, well, what's happening to me now is just what I meditated on when I was doing giving and taking. Okay, here's a great one, isn't it? So this, I thought the answer to this was tremendous. So why must we practice patience? Anyone? Bruce?
To establish virtue in our continuum.
Yeah, to actually protect the virtue that's been established.
Yeah, that was the thing, protecting it's protecting the big one, the isn't it?
Man, that was
that got me in.
Me too. That's
what God outrage the virtue.
Yeah, protecting to protect virtue. So we've all got virtue in our mind stream, but like the anger destroys it or renders us incapable of calling upon it and using it and so forth. So Kinsa Rinpoche said, we need to establish virtue in our mental continuum, and having established that virtue, we need to protect it. Otherwise, negativities like anger might come along and snatch it away from us. So this is why we need to be patient. In fact, as you said, the indispensable technique, because it allows us to protect our virtues. Yes, this is the one that got me too, Caroline. Yes, Yvette, yep.
Just on the topic of anger, anger is to want to harm others. That's the definition of anger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But just before anger, I frequently feel this thing that's not anger, not wanting to hurt another, but it's an irritation.
Sure.
You know, like, why did that bus driver pull up there when they could have just, you know what I mean? That sort of petty little, and it seems to be repetitive. And the more you do it, the worse it gets. And you seem to get into this thing happening to you over and over rather than just sort of chilling and going, it is what it is.
Yeah.
I guess we just apply the same thing to this thing that isn't quite anger, but it's
Precluding.
Precluding.
In the teachings on the First Noble Truth, when they talk about sufferings and its causes. So you can say anger could be a cause or it could also be an effect, couldn't it? So when it's an effect, and then you're, what you're doing here, you're stepping back and going, but something made it arise, some of the causes, and then you describe them, right, like irritation. In those teachings, you get what you don't want. And that's, this is what, this is a good thing to remember, isn't it? Because while you're in samsara, we are going to keep on getting what we don't want. So if you know that, if you focus on getting what you don't want, it'll lead to anger. And so this is when you can sort of use that other one about like you're getting what you don't want, which will, which you have to sort of accept.
And Eddie, also, if you just like focusing on what you don't want leads to anger, then if we just let the anger percolate, then it'll go from not expressing it to expressing it, which is leading to the harm, to the hatred, the kind of the activity of anger. So it's that trajectory that if we don't counter it, it grows and goes into hatred. So like Yvette was saying about, you know, before hatred there is the anger. It hasn't kind of fully manifested as hatred.
That's right. Before, so you've got hatred, anger, before that resentment. So there's a sort of a continuum here, Yvette, or like an arc.
Yeah, it's just not even that. It's just irritation, and it's like multiple lots of irritation, and you just have to be mindful all the time, and it's so easy to get into the habit of keep having these minor irritations, and then it puts a heaviness on you because you don't realize, oh, I'm actually empty. Which part is it actually affecting? You know, you've got to, so constant, you've got to constantly remind yourself there's nothing to be affected. Yeah. But it's just a habit, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And so then it's like, you know, the habit of disliking getting what you don't want. Right. So I remember this, one of my things was going, of course. You know, it's like agree instead of disagree, because it's the disagreement that leads you to the anger and then, of course, the hatred if it really escalates.
And Eddie, also, like that third point of what patience is, of certainty in the Dharma, that kind of comes in here, that if we focus on all the things that we don't like, getting what we don't want, we've forgotten about that First Noble Truth that you mentioned. We've forgotten about our Dharma wisdom.
Yeah, another thing I remember here was Kinsa Rinpoche saying was, the takeaway from studying the First Noble Truth was you're not in control. You know, so that we do get these things happening to this event, like, you know, we do get what we don't want. What we do want is lost to us. You know, these things are just natural. So we're going to sort of like, if we can agree, like I've gone, like, of course, then we can do something, then we can work. But when we sort of don't want it, trying to push it away, it doesn't help.
Eddie,
yeah.
I'm sorry, I can't get my video to come on. Oh, there it is.
You just have to say it. It's all good.
I've been trying for 10 minutes to get this video to work. Where is it gone again? It's gone. I just...
How's your patience going with that, Jeanette? Trying to get the video going?
No, I'm patient. I'm just keeping going. Tap, tap, tap. I think sometimes we have too many expectations of other people. We expect them to behave in certain ways, and when they don't, we get angry. So I've learned to lower my expectations, or have no expectations most of the time.
Yeah.
Because if I do, I'm going to be disappointed and get angry with the person.
Yeah, one of the things we can expect while we are unenlightened is to suffer. You know, and that others will also will be the same. If others are unenlightened, they'll suffer, and it'll come across, they'll blame the external world. Yeah, and while we're unenlightened, we will experience mental suffering at least, and physical too. Caroline.
Well, yeah, so they have on page 9, the on the notes, that quote I've read before, that a moment's anger can destroy virtues of generosity and ethical discipline accumulated over hundreds of eons, which is a bit sort of, you know, drastic. But that when it says towards a conqueror's child, is that specifically your anger towards a bodhisattva just destroys everything?
Or yeah, well, let's leave that for now, because that comes up later on in the questioning.
And we've got questions
to go before that. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, okay, good. You'll explain it then, because I don't understand it.
That material goes over for this week, a little bit this week, and a lot of next week.
Right.
Also, I think Jeanette had something else. Jeanette, did you have something else to add?
No, well, it was just I find myself, a lot of my friends, when I'm getting angry, is because they expect too much from someone else. It's always the expectations, and I try to say to them, that's because you're expecting them to do this or do that, but it never seems to convince them. They're still angry.
That's right. Well, like so you say, one of the things is one of the things they probably are expecting from them is for them to be better than what they actually are. And when they aren't that way, then they get upset.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, I mean, this is just Buddhism 101, isn't it? It's like there's those people who don't have anger and have done all the work and are clean and clear, and they're called Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And then there's us, the sentient beings.
It's even just Facebook 101, because Facebook often puts up, you know, the things of everybody's fighting their own battles. Everyone is doing the best that they can, given what on earth is going on in their life. But that's what we forget.
So, Eddie, Jeanette's got a really good point about expectation, I think. So is the expectation, like Jeanette was describing, is that related also to attachment? That we have an attachment to how we think others should be, and we get angry or we've got an attachment, we get angry at ourselves, that we can't get rid of that attachment? Is that expectation and attachment?
Yeah, there's an overestimation of where they'd like people to actually be. In one way, you could say we could all become enlightened. We all have Buddha nature. That's for certain. But at the same time, we're not enlightened and we're actually suffering. And that's also true. And if you don't have some sort of background in Dharma, then you get, just as you're saying, Jeanette, right? People expect others to be actually better than where they are at present. And they're disappointed when they're not. But one of the things that says with if you're unenlightened, expect to suffer. And you'll always meet it. you'll have your expectations met. Also understand that because we have Buddha nature, we can actually put an end to that suffering. That's also true. So let's just re-establish our motivation, thinking that we're studying the perfection of patience as a means to put an end to our own hostility, lack of courage, to help others attain enlightenment. Okay, let's come to. So we've been talking about why we need patience, and in essence, it's to protect our virtue. Now, the next thing is we come up to a quote next. And in part of that quote, there's a section that says it. It actually says here, patience against the fault of anger protects all that is excellent in this world. Patience against the fault of anger protects all that is excellent in this world. And the question is asked, for us to find all the analogies within the quote where this line is in. So let's I'll read you out the quote, and then we'll go through some of these analogies. So here's the quote. It's from the Compendium of the Perfections. It says, "It is said, patience is the best approach for dealing with the inclination to disregard others' welfare. Patience against the fault of anger protects all that is excellent in this world. Patience is the best ornament of the powerful, the greatest strength for those who practice asceticism, and a stream of water on the wildfire of malice. Patience clears away much harm in this and future lives. The arrows of undisciplined people's words are dulled by a superior being's armor of patience. These unruly people then give pleasant flowers of praise, which become attractive garlands of flame, of fame." Sorry. So there's a quote from the Compendium of the Perfections, and the question is, how many analogies can you find which illustrate the quote? So anybody come up with a number at all?
I'm not sure. I didn't count, but there was a further quote. I'm taking it that it was a continuation from that same quote that says, "Patience is also the craftsman that creates a Buddha's embodiment of form,
yeah,
adorned with beautiful signs of good qualities."
Yeah,
I think that was, it was from the same passage. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it says, "and also."
Yeah. So there's half a dozen there at least.
Yeah, that's right. At least half a dozen. There's more than, yeah, there's more than six. I think. Yeah, so I didn't put that one in, Bruce. That would have given me like eight, I think, with that one there. Yeah, that's right. So I've got, I come up with eight anyway.
But where is this, Eddie? I'm lost a bit.
So the quote is on page 153.
Oh, right.
In the
okay.
Great Treatise.
Right.
That's the
okay.
Bottom quote, Compendium of Perfections.
Oh, right. I was looking at the notes. Okay, thanks.
So this is definitely one of them here. It says, patience against the fault of anger protects all that is excellent in this world. So it's asked us, you know, find out how many we can find. I come up with eight. And then it asks us for some of the meanings of these, you know, what's the meaning of each analogy. So what do you think about this one here? Patience against the fault of anger protects all that is excellent in this world.
Eddie, this one kind of makes me think that, taking it the other way, that if we don't have patience, then even even the good things that we do will be destroyed by our anger. People wrote, even remember the good things that we do if we're angry or short-tempered. So, you know, patience protects all of our good qualities from being besmirched like that.
Yeah. It's like that question before, you know, when Geshe asked them, one of the questions, why do we have to practice patience? The answer is to protect your virtue. And this is what this quote is getting at. So all the excellent things in the world, meritorious virtues and so forth, and their resulting happiness can all be destroyed by anger. A moment of anger can wipe out the merit it took years to create. Because powerful anger has this fault, we need protection from it. The protection, says Shantideva, is patience. So I think if you guys look back over your lives, there might have been instances where you've been friendly with people, had them as friends, shared a lot of experiences and time with them, and then maybe one of you got angry with one another and then you got separated from one another. And all that goodness that was developed in their time was like lost. You know, you can't draw upon it. This happens a lot of, in cases of divorce, doesn't it?
Eddie, you're looking away from the microphone.
So?
You're getting very quiet.
So this is referring to how patience protects our virtue. This one here. So one of the other lines, the best approach for dealing with the inclination to disregard others' welfare. This is also a line in the quote. So what's the meaning of this one? Anyone, any suggestions?
Just, I mean, on a practical level, it's like sometimes it's very tempting to say, I just don't care.
Yep, that's right.
When you're under stress or you feel under stress. And if you immediately just put in place the tool of patience, it stops you taking that feeling any further into expression so that people then feel disregarded. And I'm just lucky enough to be speaking from work experience there.
Yeah,
that's very much that not my problem sort of thing that comes up quite a lot, particularly at work, I think, you know, where there's a lot of demarcation goes on, where you just actually put up barriers to caring.
I've got an example from pretty recently, because I work in the hospital now, in the hospital system. As you know, it's can be quite hard work getting some Indigenous people or people with a First Nations background to engage with the big hospital systems.
Yep.
And being on the front door, I've seen a lot of really great local people recently. And a lady came in, we worked through what we thought she needed to do, we sent her up to another department, and they were just really rude and sent her away. And that could have totally destroyed a whole family's relationship with the health system, because this one person in the pharmacy section just made it so obvious she didn't give a stuff about this family's welfare, and she probably does, but she was really, really impatient and angry with her.
Yeah.
So that could have cut out a lot of really good health outcomes for an entire family for a couple of generations.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things here. So this is what it's sort of getting at here is so if you take that example you just gave, Rosemary, so one of the things we could become impatient with there is how the woman dealt with the person from dealt with the Aboriginal woman.
Yeah, and she probably and this woman in the pharmacy probably wasn't inclined to disregard the other's welfare, but she put her own sense of being put upon first. It, whereas if she just immediately put patience into practice, it would have been a better outcome for her, a better outcome for the people she was working with.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, in the Lam Chenmo, it says, this means it stops you turning away from others' welfare on account of living beings' misperceptions.
Yes, and the woman that she was, the Indigenous family, came back downstairs to me and they were just so upset, so disappointed, so angry that yeah. Because they felt they'd really been disregarded.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that's, you say you're right, Rosemary. So from the person who worked in the pharmacy, if she could have been patient, then everything would have worked out well.
I just think it would have been a much better outcome.
Well, well it would have, yeah, it probably would have been. And, yeah, like I say, so from if you look at from the woman in the pharmacy, a misperception took place. She misperceived something about the Aboriginal people and was perhaps abrupt or brusque or whatever, and, you know, the Aboriginal people came down quite upset. So if we have patience, then that won't happen.
So, Eddie, this is like the implications of this are quite terrifying, because when we are just oblivious to the welfare of others, we have no idea that it can have these, like Rosemary's discussing, catastrophic consequences for generations. Yeah, we're just like having a bad day.
Yeah, that's right.
Or even a bad 5 seconds.
5 seconds, that's right.
Yeah, if I may, Eddie, this speaks to me that, you know, all of us have the inclination for the path of sort of least resistance, you know, inherently. And if we don't have to deal with tough things or difficult decisions, we will avoid them. Yeah. And by taking that path, though, it's impatience ultimately at play, and our sort of avoidance to, you know, really get into anything that might be even slightly difficult. Even though we have the skills to deal with it, we don't always do that.
No, no.
And I think that's in the outcomes can be, as we've heard, though, unfortunately quite catastrophic for the other individual. But I think here it's our self-centeredness, it's our ego as well that we're trying to protect a lot of time. So yeah, great point.
So here's sort of pointing out how our own impatience with our own suffering.
Can I just put a point?
Sure.
On the opposite to that is sometimes you have to wait on the phone a long time to get through to someone because you need their help because you don't know how to use a computer.
Sure.
And I've experienced you sort of just accept that now these days that you're going to be on the phone for maybe 20 minutes waiting to get through to a person. And you accept that and you don't have I don't have a problem with that anymore because we're so used to it. And I'm amazed at the patience that people have with me and my inability to navigate anything on the computer. So, and these people, sometimes young men and women, are just have incredible patience with me. And I just feel such a good experience from that. So it's where people have practiced patience and you do have great gratitude for them practicing that patience. And so that's the other side of it.
Yeah. Well, this is what I'm saying. It's the best approach. I say being patient is the best approach.
Eddie.
Dealing with this inclination. Yeah?
It's Jeanette. Still haven't worked out my video. I'd just like to know how Rosemary felt about the woman in the pharmacy having caused all this problem. Does she feel angry towards the lady in the pharmacy?
That's a great question, Jeanette. I was disappointed, really disappointed. because, as Yvette was just saying, 99.9% of the staff in the hospital that I'm fortunate enough to be associated with are absolutely astounding people. They are so patient. And I have just learned so much because from the work there, because they're in such challenging situations all through their work day, every day. And their patience and their kindness is extraordinary. So I suppose you could say I was really taken aback by this one person and this one event.
You know, all right. Thank you.
At the bad face seconds. But yeah, 99.9% of the people there absolutely emanate patience, and it's a wonderful environment for watching it in practice.
Okay, thank you. So, Eddie, can I just ask you one other thing? When you say when anger arises, but you don't express it, you keep it within yourself.
Yeah.
Does that destroy any virtue that you've created, or is it?
It harms you.
Express your anger, but what if you stop your anger? You can stop it before you express it.
That's not really stopping anger, though. That's just not expressing it, but the anger's still there. Stopping anger would be dismantling it so you don't actually have anger.
So you would still destroy your virtue then.
The anger's got the intention to harm, isn't it? So intention's a mental factor. Whether it's actually carried out or not, that's another story.
Yes, so I think that you're more likely to get depression if depression's anger turned in on itself. So you're more likely to get depression. But isn't it, Shanta Davis says, if you feel like something is about to come up, be like a piece of wood, you know. Don't react to it, but then that would give you the time to process it mentally as well, you know.
Yes.
Sorry.
So remember too, like with anger, it's got to have this intention to harm, isn't it? So not all anger has that, but not all anger has an intention to harm a person or a living being.
Mm.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so the next part of this quote says that patience is the best ornament of the powerful. And the Lam Chidmo says it's a captivating ornament, patience is, because it endures the harm of those of little power. So remember before I said saying about how first noble truth to take away from that is you don't have any power, you don't have control. Your mind is in control over you, and what's in control of the mind is the disturbing emotions.
Eddie, just pause the screen share for a moment. That's great. Then you can just look at the, yeah.
So I guess Yusopa says in relationship to this part of the quote, a real ornament of great beauty pleases everyone who sees it. Kings are adorned with lots of jewelry and have the power to grant great assistance or cause great injury. But these royal attributes are not holy or real ornaments. Patience is the true ornament, because everyone who sees those with patience wants to be near them, be under their guidance, receive their help, and so forth. The great power of patience pleases everyone because it offers protection and assistance. The next part is it's the greatest strength for those who practice asceticism. So the meaning of this analogy. So there are all sorts of different ways to practice asceticism. different forms of hardships that you might endure. For instance, by doing a nungne. Patience, it says here, is the greatest strength, the supreme strength for those who are engaged in acts of hardship. So there are many difficulties that we will encounter when we practice Dharma. So accepting those sort of difficulties is what we call dealing with hardship. So the source one of the things that says, the source of people's patience is the wisdom realizing the advantages of practice and the disadvantages of a worldly life. So if you don't, I think, until we come across these types of presentations in the Buddha Dharma, we don't really know what patience is. It's just like it's more like the first one, isn't it? Just disregarding harm. And for most of us, we don't know the good reasons for doing that. Many advantages for doing so, and the disadvantages whereby if we lose our patience. So this was like, patience gives you the ability to endure our difficulties and to live an austere life. Another part of the quote, this is like, it's a stream of water on the wildfire of malice. So I think this one's not so hard to get your head around, is it, in terms of the analogy. So they're comparing anger here to, or malice, to like a wildfire, destroying all the roots of your virtue. So Kinsa Rinpoche says here, the intention to harm renders our roots of virtue incapable of producing their effects. Now the same is true for fire and the seeds of a tree. If you place a seed for a tree in a fire, it will burn it up so that the seed no longer has the capacity or ability to produce the tree. Similarly, malice or ill will, the intention of harm, burns up our roots of virtue, rendering them incapable of producing the pleasant effect. Patience is like water that will put that out. Geshe Sopa says, a hateful mind is like fire. Just as a fire can spread to every tree in a dry area, anger can destroy our virtues and inflame others. If we drench a fire with water, we can stop the destruction. Similarly, patience is the stream of water that can put out the fire of anger. If the fire of anger is left unchecked, then we will create a lot of negative karma. The next one is, it clears away much harm in this and future lives. So from Geshe Sopa, he says, injuring others, retaliating for our own selfish purposes and so forth, will result in much misery in this and future lives. Patience eliminates those problems. In this life, it eliminates our enemies because we do not retaliate against perceived harm. Instead of harming others, we will try to benefit them. As a result, we'll have nothing to worry about in the future. Yes, so in your story, Rosemary, I was wondering if anybody was able to go up to the woman who was serving in the... you and probably maybe some other people would have helped the Aboriginal woman who went up to the... to get assistance. I wonder if anybody went up there to see the woman up there and ask her how she was.
No, but probably should have done. One of the first thing she get trained about there is obviously you try and do your best and always be patient and this kind of thing. But one of the first things they ever talk about is you don't know what's going on for other people.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, one thing you can be certain of, we don't know what's going on for others. We certainly don't know specifically, but in general we can know that if that person's unenlightened, they're suffering to some degree or other.
And if they're in a hospital, they're clearly suffering.
It's pretty obvious then, isn't it?
But
you'd be amazed.
It also reminds me too of when you were going up to Centrelink and had to have an interview there and how you took all of the Centrelink ladies that were working there an ice cream each when you went up there. I thought that was so skillful because, you know, you're so under the hammer and everybody just hates your guts when they come in, that they're, you know, as a way of actually thinking about it from their side as well, even though they are actually, you know, they're supposed to be paid to be patient and help.
Okay, here we've got another metaphor. Analogy, sorry. The arrows of undisciplined people's words are dulled by a superior being's armor of patience. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? So harsh words can be compared to like the arrows. So an arrow, of course, if it were to hit you, would hurt you. Yet patience dulls the arrow so that it doesn't hurt. Patience is armor that cannot be pierced by the arrows of undisciplined persons' misperception. So I think there's a number of things we have to remember if we are to wear the armor of patience. One of the most basic things of all is that whenever you come into contact with sentient beings, you must know that they're actually driven by suffering. What's driving them is karma and delusion. And yet we seem to forget that. I think it's one of the most basic things we're taught. It's the first noble truth, isn't it? So they actually lack control over themselves. They're under the control of karma and delusion. So then they are going to say and do things that will harm us. And what's being said is that we need to be patient with that. Now, it's sort of the first form of patience. So we need to be patient with them coming at us. And then the second is our own mind has to be patient. And then the third one, of course, is, you know, being patient with the use, the knowledge and use and application of Dharma. So knowing that, you know, like we are not enlightened beings, so we don't have good control over our mind, but at least we have access to the Buddha Dharma. We've come across it. We're interested in it. Most people have not come across it, and they're just naturally wild. So they are going to hurt us with what they say and what they do. We will be hurt, then we've got to sort of go, okay, now don't lose it ourselves. Be patient with the suffering that your own mind is undergoing and use something like, this is the fruit of suffering, or this suffering, my own bewilderment is coming to an end. Oh, I know, here's my chance to do giving and taking. Right? And then, you know, that bringing in the third one, isn't it? The understanding of karmic cause and effect and emptiness and some sort of thing we can do. So Geshe Sopa says in relationship to this, People under the power of hatred often shoot arrows of poisonous words. Sometimes words are so powerful they cause pain worse than a beating. Even one sharp word can make us miserable for days or even years. If we do not have patience, then hearing those angry words makes us angry as well. But words like those cannot penetrate the armor of patience. The words do nothing. They are just sound. A patient person smiles and continues to want to make the other person happy. Slowly, the angry person will cool down. The furious words will turn into praise. It's as if he or she were tossing flowers. So the term superior beings refers to Buddhas, and in addition to Bodhisattvas, who have actually produced compassion and love. Now, the last one, which I didn't put up a slide for, was the one about the last bit that Bruce said, the last couple of sentences for the quote, which I missed out. But the benefit, or what it's trying to say there, is that with patience, you actually can develop the two body, the two form body, the two bodies of a Buddha. And then it says, the next question, now list as many benefits of patience as you can find in the text. So there's a heap of them. I just found another nine there. So persons who have patience will not have many enemies later. They'll not have many separations from those to whom they are close. Third, they have much happiness and contentment. Fourth, they don't have regret at the time of death. Five, upon the disintegration of their bodies, they'll also be reborn among the deities in the happy realms of high status. Six, by looking at such benefits of patience, they too become patient. So I know that's a fact. If you start seeing the truth in some of these things and decide to apply it, works for you. They engage others in upholding patience, they praise patience, and patient persons are delighted and full of joy. So I just put up like three of the many benefits of them. So of course, what do you think's the purpose of them putting up all these benefits of patience? Caroline?
So it's about how to train our mind so we understand those benefits, and then we take those benefits into meditation and really kind of meditate on those benefits to actually actualize and habituate our mind with patience.
Yeah, so the benefits are put forward so that we can become familiar with those benefits and then become patient people. Like, you know, one of the things I read the other day was there's a lot of profit for us. There's a lot of gain for us in becoming patient people.
But you have to take it into meditation, I would have to. Pardon?
What is meditation?
Familiarizing your mind.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's all it means, right? To become familiar with it.
But you need to understand the benefits, so you need to have that list and then, understand what that means, like you've been doing well. And so with the wisdom of contemplation, as Geshe Zopa calls it, you then take that into develop the wisdom of meditation.
So like this first one, let's have a look at that, use that as an example. Persons who have patience will not have many enemies later. Seems like a no-brainer, doesn't it? So if you ever, it's just a simple thing, you start reflecting back and go, okay, so when I've been angry at somebody or somebody's been really angry at me, next time we see each other, Do we like each other? Do I think well of them? Am I friends with them? Are you? I'm not. I don't like you. And so it's like over there, mate. And that would be the same with me. If I were to become angry at persons, people don't like it. So then it's so in this thing, so you have an enemy now. You have someone who doesn't like you. That's just the real fact, isn't it? So it's like taking those things and just relating it back to yourself and go, that's true. I don't want to have enemies. I don't want to be looking over my shoulder. I don't want, you know, when I need help and I ask for it, I'd like to be assisted. That's not going to happen if somebody looks at me as an enemy. Right? So it's that sort of thing that, like I said, there's a great benefit of not having enemies. And I only have enemies when I have anger towards others and generate a sense of distrust between me and another. Right? So, you know, I was thinking, I remember this worked for me all the time when I was in jail. Like when you're in jail, believe me, you don't want to have enemies. You do not want to be offside with people. And so, you know, so I was very calm. Well, I can help people, I help them. I never, ever say anything disparaging about anybody. You know, because the worst things can happen to you in there if people don't like you. In fact, I remember one time we walked past they've got a thing called the yard. So there's a whole lot of people out there. And there were a couple of Aboriginal blokes out there. And so as we walked past, there was myself and this other fellow who was friendly with me. He was much shorter than me. And the Aboriginal guys asked us to get them some water. But they didn't just ask pleasantly. They asked quite like roughly, threateningly, and rudely. So my mate took exception to that. Man, bad luck for you, buddy. Like, so he went, you know, and got smart back to them. So they go, oh, my God. Now he's got two big Aboriginal blokes, not just two big Aboriginal blokes, but the whole Aboriginal community in jail. Now go, this white guy, he's off. Right? Which means you got 30 Aboriginal people, you can't turn your back on them. One moment of anger, one moment of resentment, because he couldn't take the harsh words of these, the way these guys asked for water. Right? So, you know, as soon as Alan, my mate, went into this, these two guys just come straight across, and I went over to the tap, got in the water, walked across. Here you go, mate. You know, you call them mate. You don't take exception to them. Now they're like, I'm fine. But it wasn't enough for these guys to forgive my mate for what he said to them. So that's not just in a jail, of course. It's like everywhere, isn't it? You know, people follow you in the car and then this road rage thing comes up, isn't it? They get really angry and they hop out and they come across the car. Well, you better be calm and patient. You better be ready to accept that they're suffering a great deal and they got things to say. Otherwise, yeah, the worst things happen, don't they? There's a story some a few years ago where there's a man... water. Remember we had the water restrictions?
Mm.
And the guy was out there watering the lawn. And the young bloke walked past and he said, hey, mate, you shouldn't be watering the lawn. Water restrictions. This guy went, what? Turned around and hosed him with the water, right? This bloke leapt over the fence. The old bloke fell down with a heart attack and died. And this young fellow had to go to court for manslaughter. Just like that. Because they become impatient.
Yeah, that was a Brisbane guy. He was only young, like he's like 19 or 20 or something. And like completely a few words changed the course of his life. And yeah, I mean, then living with that, with being the cause of someone's death like
yeah,
that.
That's right. So yeah, one of the other things is by looking at such benefits, the benefits of patients, they too become patient. And that's really the whole point of bringing up all these benefits of patience, is to try and get some of them into your head and put them off to your own experiences and go, gee, that's right. Better be patient. Yes, the stories I could tell you about the benefits of being patient in the jungle. There's a lot of impatient people in there. Now let's go on. And there are four main benefits of patience. So I know first is happiness in this life. That's for sure. Second is you stop future miserable realm rebirths. So you don't want to die angry. Last few moments of your life, and don't try not to die angry. Be patient. If you can do that, and of course, if you're not reborn in the miserable realms, you must be reborn in the happy realms. And the last result, of course, is achieving certain goodness, which means liberation or enlightenment. So I might just say what Geshe Sopa says. He says, Tsongkhapa explains that just practicing occasionally will not work very well. If we make patience a daily practice, we will always experience joy. Even if we are in physical pain, the mind will be happy. We see this in an ordinary way with people who play sports. Running, boxing, and so forth can cause sore muscles and broken bones, but athletes are joyful because they see a purpose to their suffering. Their goals are limited, perhaps some money or fame. If we see the spiritual benefit we will gain from the practice of patience in this and future lives, not just for ourselves, but for all mother sentient beings, then we can truly feel joy that doesn't degenerate. During this time, we'll always be happy, and our future lives will not be in the lower realms. Even if we must be reborn in the world prior to attaining enlightenment, our rebirths will be special higher states. Good life after good life, we will finally attain the definite high achievement of emancipation or enlightenment. From now on, to attain enlightenment, the result of patience is to be continuously peaceful and happy. Actually, I put up a post yesterday, I think, about a woman, one of the oldest women living in the world. She died, I think she was 122. So when they asked her, like, how did she feel at 120? She said all the things that, she was very tired, her body was very sore. So she named all these things, and then she said, but I'm all right. And I went, man, there it is. It's okay, I'm all right. Oi. So there is a great fault of anger here, and the question is, what is it? What's the fault that's really concerned with here? So, what is it? The great fault of anger concerns the hidden destruction of virtue, which we are unaware of. And so most of us, I'm sure, until we come to Buddhist teachings, even in ordinary life, isn't it? I think we're all quite aware of the destruction that takes place with anger in our present life, how unhappy we can be, how we can have enemies, how it really puts other people offside, breaks families up, marriages, all sorts of things like that. We know about that. But the hidden destructive power of it, that's not something we're all that familiar with. And this is where the topic now turns into the anger put forward to different bodhisattvas at different levels of the path, and also bodhisattvas who might get angry with others. So one of the things they said in the text was, one moment of anger is so powerful it can destroy the virtues created over 1,000 eons. And another section of the text that talks about anger being so powerful, it can destroy the merits over 100 eons. And these merits here are the merits to do with generosity, don't they, and ethics. However, not every moment of anger is this strong. So if you remember, there are many different levels of anger. So to determine how powerful a moment of anger is, we need to look at the person who is getting angry, how the anger is arising, and the object of the anger. And we come into this discussion about the roots of virtue, which are destroyed. So the first question is, are the roots of virtue destroyed in the same way if the person you are angry with does have the faults you are angry with? So are the faults of virtue destroyed in the same way if the person you are angry with does have those faults? It's either a yes or a no, isn't it? So the answer is yes. Whether or not a person ascertains that the object of their anger is a bodhisattva, whether the faults that are a basis for the anger are accurate or not, the roots of virtue that are destroyed are the same in all cases. So when it's asserted that the roots of virtue are not really destroyed, what's the answer to that assertion?
Is it because anger is around intention and the intention is still there?
Or is it that because anger is a distorted state of mind, so regardless of the object or regardless of whether the details are true, the actual angry response is a distortion?
Is it about the roots of virtue can't ripen rather than being destroyed completely? There's an inability for them to ripen.
Yeah, that's just on track here, Bruce. Mm-hmm. So it says, Kensa Rinpoche says, in the manuals they use in studying the middle way, the destruction of roots of virtue is described in the following way. To destroy the root of virtue means to render a seed of virtue to become incapable of producing a pleasant effect. So then the Lam Rim Chenmo says, even the purification wherein ordinary beings clear away non-virtue by means of its remedy, the four powers of confession and so forth, it's not an abandonment of seeds. So all it's saying is that the seeds can't issue a fruition. It's not that they're destroyed completely, but they cannot produce, if they're the seeds of virtue, they can't produce this pleasant effect. Now, so when you hear that, what do you think that means? It can't produce a pleasant effect. Does it mean it cannot produce a pleasant effect whatsoever? Or does it mean it can't produce a particular type of pleasant effect. Any ideas? Linda, did you have a read of this, the material? Or Delma?
No, I haven't read it, sorry.
Okay.
I had a read of it. So I think, I'm trying to think of it now, but I think it can still give an effect, but not necessarily the, you know, a pleasant effect. So it can give a something else.
Yeah. So the clue here, I think, was they talk about what the pleasant effect it cannot produce is the fruitional pleasant effect. So what's the fruitional pleasant effect, anybody?
The ripening effect.
So that's the rebirth, isn't it?
That's right.
What rebirth you're going to go into in next life.
That's right. So it cannot produce the pleasant effect of being reborn in the higher realms.
So that's the fully ripened effect. It can't produce the fully ripened effect of a rebirth.
That's right, which is called a fruitional effect. So if that happens, then also, of course, then the environmental effects that would go along with that fruitional effect also won't come to fruition. Yeah. However, destruction of a particular karmic seed means that a specific life or quality of life will never occur as a result of this individual cause. However, anger or another destructive mental affliction does not necessarily destroy every result of a virtuous act or one's entire practice of virtue. The potential for some results may be destroyed, while some may be just lessened. Anger may destroy the primary result of a karma, but the result corresponding to the cause may not be destroyed. Now, so remember, when they talk about karma, you've always got to look at, there are four types of karma here. There's always, at least start there. And you go, okay, fruitional karma, environmental karma. Then karma similar to the cause, karma similar in terms of behavior. Then sort of start going and go, okay, what are they talking about here? You go, okay, the one they're saying for certain that destroys the, or, you know, blah, 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 is the fruitional effect. That's for certain. The others, it's not so certain.
So, Eddie, in terms of, when we get angry, then it actually destroys our capacity for experiencing joy, help, pleasure, enjoyment, any of those things, just on a relative and a fairly immediate level. So that is disconnecting us from one of the effects of that karmic seed.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other thing, of course, it does. But nevertheless, you know, it's like, so we can still have like the habits of being virtuous or the habits of being angry. So those are not destroyed. So anyway, let's go on to the next one, because here we've got this little bit about the seeds. So next week goes into more material about this. Oh, sorry. So what does it mean? Here's the question. What does it mean to say that the seeds of virtue are destroyed by anger? It means the seeds of virtue are rendered incapable of producing their pleasant fruition. So the fruitions always relate to the rebirth. Is the seed completely lost? No, it's not. It's not completely abandoned. It's not an elimination. So what's lost then? The capacity to produce a pleasant fruitional effect. That's what's lost. Is the seed still a functioning thing? Will it produce an effect? Yes, it will. Does it mean the seed has an effect? Yes. And the effect is a latter moment of similar type.
Can you explain that latter moment of similar type?
We'll come into that a bit later, okay. Because then we talk about these different continuums of karma.
Okay.
And that's, so Berzin does a lot of material on this, if you want to have a look at his site. But it's quite convoluted. So here Geshe Sopa says, anger may destroy the primary result of a karma, but the result corresponding to the cause may not be destroyed. A result corresponding to the cause is to enjoy doing a similar type of activity. For example, if you accustom yourself to the practice of generosity, in a future life you will naturally be inclined to be charitable. Anger can cause various things to happen. Sometimes the main result is destroyed, but the result corresponding to the cause is not destroyed. Sometimes the result corresponding to the cause is destroyed, but the main result is not destroyed. And sometimes, as mentioned earlier, a new bodhisattva's anger will slow his or her progress on the path. In short, Tsongkhapa says that just the same, confession can purify certain aspects of negative karma. It does not mean that all the functions of that negative karma are gone. Saying anger destroys merit. Saying anger destroys merit does not mean that every function of that merit is made non-existent. That's the thing to take away, right? How much of the root of merit is cut can only be seen by those with omniscience. So we must depend upon our study of the scriptures, our teacher or the Buddha, to understand how much damage is actually done.
So Eddie, that's it's quite a relief to hear that it's not just every single bit is destroyed, but because often, you know, if we do destroy our roots of merit or we do get angry, pretty soon after that we might really regret it as well. So that would stop the 100% destruction.
Yeah. I just think about what to say to you, Linda, about effects of a latter moment of similar type. So here we're really talking about subtle impermanence and how the disintegration of a phenomena produces an effect. So even though this seed cannot produce the fruitional effect, it nevertheless continues to disintegrate and can produce other effects of similar type. So if it was virtuous, it must produce virtue. But it won't be, a fruitional effect. So we've come to the end. We did this. We looked at the first teaching on the perfection of patience. We looked at how to cultivate it, and we looked at these 16 questions and their answers. Now, I know next week has a lot more to do with this seed and roots of virtue and things like that. So have a look at this material that you might have. If you have the Labyrinth Chenmo, Volume 2, it's 156 to 161. That's what's covered next week. Have a look at Module 3 and Teaching 2. Because, like I said, it's all about the seeds and the roots of virtue. And you can read more about it on pages 354 to 368 on Steps of the Path. Next week we'll do a similar type thing. There'll probably be about the same amount of questions.
Next fortnight.
Next fortnight, thank goodness. <You're> preparation for this. Anyway, I wanted to say thank you, everyone, for coming along and being here. It really makes a big difference to my studies, that's for sure, and I really enjoy talking to you about this material. It's if you weren't here, I wouldn't use it to refresh my own understanding of it. So it's terrific you're all interested in it. So let's dedicate our merit, thinking that by may the merit that we've created act as the causes of happiness for all sentient beings. May it bring about the end of their suffering, and may whatever suffering they experience ripen on us. May the merit be a means to keep people in touch with the happiness that is always free of suffering, and bring about the great equanimity whereby beings can acknowledge the three spheres of equality. May our enlightenment come quickly, and may our ability to help others arise just as quickly. Okay, thank you, everyone. See you next fortnight.
Thanks, Eddie.
Thanks, Eddie.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks, Eddie.
Thank you, Audrey.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.